Welcome to Oxford. Welcome to OCEF 2020. It's a pleasure to welcome you here this morning, and I hope you have a fantastic day with us. Before I hand over to the Dean to officially open the event, there are some key things that I'd like to share with you in order to make sure you have a happy, interactive, and most importantly, a healthy day. You have met many of our event staff already when you registered. If you have any questions or need any information, please look for anybody wearing a t-shirt like this, and they will be able to assist you. We are not planning any fire alarm tests today, so in the event that you do hear one, please make your way quickly and carefully out to the main entrance outside, please. Moving on to make sure you have a healthy day. First of all, if you need first aid at any point, please go to reception. This is located on the main desk. Secondly, one of the special things about OCEF is the variety of people that you can meet. In light of the latest developments relating to COVID-19, I'd like to share some alternative greetings that you can incorporate today. That may be the wave, the elbow nudge — I've already done that with some people this morning — the foot tap, or even, we kind of discussed this yesterday, maybe even like a hip five instead of a high five, okay? We do also have hand sanitizers throughout the building, so please make use of them at any time. Now, to make sure you have an interactive day, OCEF uses the app Attendee Hub. This can be downloaded and accessed using the email address that you registered with. If you have any questions, please let us know. Make sure you allow push notifications to stay updated throughout the day. Mark which sessions you want to attend. Please note these are on a first-come, first-served basis. Connect with attendees, make sure that your profile is visible, and check out the amazing exhibitors and speakers that we have. Dedicated Wi-Fi is available, so the codes there are up on the screen. Please feel free to take a photo. Finally, I don't often get a chance to thank the amazing team that supports me in pulling this day together, and I will say they are a stellar team. So just really quickly to introduce them from left to right, Natalie has coordinated the pitch competition. We have Miranda, who has been making sure that we have the most coolest and most fun exhibitors for you today. Louisiana has been the creator of our beautiful branding and so many other marketing elements. We have Ben, our events and logistics guru. And finally, Serena, who has been making sure that we have a great speaker lineup. Also in the past few weeks, she has been she has self-appointed herself the coronavirus research officer in our building. So please give them a wave, give them an elbow nudge, whatever you prefer when you see them around. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to get this day officially started and hand over to the stage Peter Tufano, Dean of Said Business School. Thank you.
Good morning. Oh, that's really lame. Good morning. Good morning. Excellent. So Libby gave you a lot of ways of greeting. I'd like to give you one more that's, I think, quite relevant to today, and that is namaste. Namaste means I bow to the divine in you. And if we think about what that means, I bow to the divine in you. What is divine? Divine is just, merciful, kind. But divine is also creative. The divine can create. Divine creates because they can. Entrepreneurs create because they can't. If you think about the definition of entrepreneurship, it's the pursuit of resources beyond, the pursuit of opportunity beyond the resources under your control. The pursuit of opportunity beyond the resources under your control. So what might be that resource limitation? It might be money, financial capital. You've got everything else lined up, but you need money. It might be that what you're lacking isn't money, but it's in fact people, human capital. You've got, you know, kind of everything else, but you need to assemble a team. It might be that you need customers, social capital. Or it might be that you know the problem, but you don't know the solution yet, intellectual capital. And in fact, when you think about what entrepreneurs do, unlike the divine, which I'm bowing to you, they actually create despite the fact that they don't have the resources they need to create. And that's especially important today. If we think about the... Now, today in two ways. One, that we're sitting in the midst of coronavirus, and this may be one of the last events we do for a little while with a group this big, but two, because of the topic of what OSEF is about this year, space and beyond. If we think about the topics that you're going to hear about, it's about big, hard things. If we think about the resources beyond our control, it's not just that we don't have the money sometimes in the teams, we actually are not quite sure how to solve these problems. How do we get to space in a way that is affordable and repeatable? And how do we exploit space without being, you know, exploiting it in such a way that harms the solar system and beyond? How is it that we can live longer? How is it that we can give meaningful lives to people in refugee camps that wouldn't otherwise have it? And perhaps most importantly, and for those of you who are at the school, you know that this is a major concern of ours, how is it that we arrest the problems of climate that threaten all of us? These are big, big issues. These are well beyond our pay grade, well beyond the resources we have under control. And so in terms of bowing to the divine, I think we have to kind of ask for help there, but also recognize that our creations will require us to work together. And so what OSEF is about today is some of the biggest issues. It's not about coming up with a new brand of beer that might sell or about, you know, kind of the new brand of shoe that might be popular, but addressing the big issues of the world. That's clearly the orientation of this school, but it's also the orientation of many of the speakers that we have, including, and I'm proud to say, our keynote speaker this morning, Anousheh Ansari. So, so many things to say about our keynote speaker. CEO of the X Prizes. How many of you have heard of the X Prizes before? A handful. I think you may hear about them some more. But it's basically a way to galvanize interest and attention around solving the world's biggest problems through a prize mechanism. I came to know the X Prizes relatively early. After the first few were done, one of my students was diagnosed with ALS. And there was an early, I think, X Prize or something like an X Prize for addressing Lou Gehrig's disease. So, you know, how do you take on the biggest challenges of the world and galvanize interest with a prize structure? And our speaker is the CEO of the X Prizes. She's also a noted entrepreneur herself. She was CEO of Proteus Systems. The other thing that she's done, and this is wicked cool, is that she was the first private woman space explorer. I think that's right, the first Muslim in space, as well as the first Iranian descendant in space. She's also set up something which I really want to hear more about, the $1 billion Fund for Women, which is if you are an entrepreneur and you know the field of entrepreneurship, you realize that it, sadly, like most other parts of our society and our world, is not equal, is got a gap that's pretty huge. And we've talked about this at OSEF in prior years. If you look at the fraction of entrepreneurs that are women, it's far less than the fraction in the population, maybe a quarter of the population, you know, in the teens, perhaps. And the billion prize that she's created, or the billion fund, will be to support women's entrepreneurs. So what better person to kick us off for this OSEF 2020 in the midst of coronavirus than Anousheh Ansari? Thank you very much for coming.
Good morning. It's such a pleasure to be here. I flew from Los Angeles, and up until a couple of days ago, I wasn't sure if the event would be canceled or not. So it's great to be here and to see all of you here bright and early on a Saturday morning, which is even more surprising. So I was born a long, long time ago in a country far, far away in Iran, in the second largest city in Mashhad. And growing up in Iran, I saw many changes throughout my life. I was from a modest, middle-class family, no engineers in the family. And, you know, before I was 12, my world started changing. The first change was when my parents got divorced. I was 5. But that was like a small change compared to what was about to happen in the rest of my life. When I was about 12, the revolution happened, and when I looked outside the window, I saw a lot of angry people screaming, yelling, putting cars on fire, and I couldn't understand what was happening. Before I could even adjust to that, there was a war that broke out between Iran and Iraq, and then, you know, sirens, and we had to go to shelters, and some of you come from Middle East, so you're very familiar with a lot of these things. But my world around me started changing. And fortunately, as a young child, I developed this big interest for space. So during this time of crisis for me, there was one place I could go and I could find peace and solace, and that was going out and looking at the night skies. And when I looked up at the beautiful starry nights, I was able to transport myself to another world. I used my imagination to imagine, you know, I created a spaceship and I took all of my family and friends and we all went to this beautiful planet and started a world there. Everyone could just live peacefully, a world of abundance, a world that we didn't have to fight over anything. And it shows you this power of imagination. And that was my early childhood, and I developed the love of space when I was 6, and it just continued to grow, and it made me want to become an engineer and an astronaut. Probably I was 7 or 8 years old. I was not very good in drawing, as you can see, but I drew this picture and I went around and showed it to everyone in the family and I said, here's how I'm going to go to space. It's my spaceship. And I'm sure that none of them ever imagined that it will come true, but nevertheless, I was a young girl and they didn't want to break my heart, so they probably patted me on the head and told me that, you know, this is really nice, such a nice rocket. And yes, of course you will be an astronaut. But they never imagined that I will actually make it come true. And not only I did go to space, I had to find the right rocket because you can see how it resembles my rocket. So it took me a while to find it. I was about 40 years old when I went to space station. But this is my launch, actually. It happens because I think our imagination is a very powerful gift we have as human beings. Everything that we have ever created, built, comes from our imagination. We first see it. We imagine places that never existed or we've never been to. We imagine things, products. We build things. We draw things. We create things that all come from our imagination. And as young kids, we use it a lot. As we become practical adults, we use it less and less, and it's a shame because it is truly one of the most powerful gifts we have. And it starts, you know, usually your imagination could be sparked by an idea because you saw something someplace. I saw the stars and it inspired me. Or I watched Star Trek on TV. I loved science fiction books, and it transported me to places, and I started seeing myself in those characters, and somehow, one way or another, you know, I made it come true. Sometimes just my head and sometimes with props. But as you heard, even though I always wanted to become an astronaut, that was not the initial path that I took. When I came to U.S., I didn't speak English, but I was sure that, you know, when I was growing up, I was sure by the time I get to be an adult, there will be a Starfleet Academy, and I could apply, and I'd be the, you know, science officer on board Starship Enterprise, and I would be able to travel the, you know, universe. But when I came to U.S. and I looked up Starfleet Academy, I couldn't find it anywhere in the yellow pages. And as you know, even though it's been more than 50 years where, as human beings, we've been exploring space, it had not really reached masses, even though we were promised there will be a hotel on the moon and that we will have these regular flights. It never happened. As I started, you know, deciding on my career, since I was in U.S. with my family now, I'm the elder in the family. We didn't have any money. I had to be the practical adult in the family. And, of course, my mom was very influential and told me that you need to study something that you can get a job really quickly. I come from a part of the world where the only possible jobs are being a doctor, a lawyer, or an engineer. So I could not stand the sight of blood. I couldn't argue, and I couldn't speak English, so I couldn't be a lawyer. So engineering was it. So I became an electrical engineer, computer science, and eventually met my husband and embarked on the route of entrepreneurship, which was great because I loved the combining the creativity and building things with problem solving, and it allowed us to build successful companies, which eventually became the source for me to be able to, you know, go back to my dream. But that was an important step that a lot of adults don't take, because if you have a big dream and you want to accomplish something that seems impossible, and when you're going to school, you're a little bit more optimistic about the world, and as you start getting your first car payment and loan payment and the mortgages and everything start building up, you become more and more practical and you start giving up on a lot of the dreams that seem hard. But what I found is that even though sometimes you have to delay them, you should never give up on them because you never know what's going to happen, and I'm a good example of that. So I never forgot about my dream, and part of the props you saw was I made everyone in my management team actually dress up in Star Wars costume for our all-hands meeting. They weren't so happy about it, but it was just a small way of reminding me and everyone else that this is what I want to do. Everything around the office was space theme, even though our company had nothing to do with space. But there are ways for you to really remind yourself about that. And because I did that when we sold our company, before actually starting Prodia, Prodia is our third company, I got to meet someone who had read about the story of Charles Lindbergh. His name is Peter Diamandis. You may have heard of him. He's also an amazing person and one of my good friends, and he also wanted to go to space. So he reads about Spirit of St. Louis and Charles Lindbergh's story when he flew to win a prize. He flew from New York to Paris to win a prize, and because of that flight and that success, the whole airline industry changed and was created because of it. So he decided that maybe he can do the same thing in space. So he announced the prize without having anyone to support him for that prize. On the other side of U.S., here I was, just sold my company, decided I'm going to pursue my path to go somehow find a way to go to space. I went back to school, started studying astronomy, which is what I wanted to do. And whenever I was interviewed, I always talked about space. So he reads one of my interviews, tries to find me, finally sets up a meeting and tells me about this idea he has of, you know, a competition for people to build spaceships to go to space. And imagine, this is 20 years ago. So this is before all this new space industry. And I'm like, this is a fantastic idea. Why no one else has done this before? And as an entrepreneur, it made sense to me because all these years I have been paying engineers and I've told them what I want to build, and it took several years, and sometimes they built it right, sometimes they didn't. But I had one team, and you know, I was taking a chance whether they were succeeding in building the right thing or not. But with the competition, I was able to basically put a prize up there and say, here's what I want, and challenge the entire world to go build what I wanted. And then once they finished building it, then I would give them the money. You know, this is a brilliant way of creating new things. So, of course, we became, you know, sponsors of the prize and became part of the foundation and served on the foundation board since until recently. And the prize was very successful. So the $10 million prize brought in $100 million worth of investment, which started this whole new space, private space industry. Before that, if anyone wanted to launch, no one was even allowed, or there was no entity that could regulate or give a launch permit to a private company. We had to, during the 10 years that it took to win the prize, actually worked with policymakers, with NASA, with FAA, to educate them why this was important and why creating a private space industry will actually benefit humanity. And we succeeded. There is now a group at FAA that regulates it, which allows for companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin and many others to exist and actually launch. NASA changed their policy and actually started working with private companies, which is saving them billions of dollars. And out of the 26 teams that competed for the prize, the winning team was a team from California, funded by Paul Allen. And Paul Allen actually spent $30 million to win that $10 million. This is the brilliance of the prizes. It's not just about the prize money. And the winning spaceship one is actually in Air and Space Museum next to Spirit of San Luis, which has inspired us. So I'm always very proud when I go to Air and Space Museum to see it. And this is my husband, my brother-in-law, my people who, you know, supported and sponsored the prize with me. So the prize model worked brilliantly. And this is how we work actually at XPRIZE. This is a video to explain it in a little bit
more. The XPRIZE Foundation runs incredible large-scale competitions around the world that set very clear, measurable, objective goals. The first person to build, demonstrate this capability wins the prize money. And the world gets the benefits.
Competitions and prizes can actually bring innovation to solve not just any problem, but really big, challenging problems.
I think we're about setting a high bar, and you want to set a goal for people that's inspiring, but it's also hard.
When we're designing an XPRIZE, we're looking for something that is audacious and achievable.
Goals that are far beyond where the industry is.
Problems that the markets have failed to solve.
To help people really now dig into their imagination, creativity is everywhere.
We are leveraging the genius of folks from all over the world.
The tinkers, the entrepreneurs, the engineers.
People who are not satisfied with the way things are and know that it can be better.
It's all around hopefulness. It's all about collaboration.
The long tail effect of a prize has probably as much value as the prize itself.
At every single level. I've seen things go from a paper plane to an actual spaceship.
We've seen a private spaceflight revolution.
$300 million invested into the lunar economy. Over 10 million kids integrated in STEM education work.
Technology that increased the rate of cleaning up oil spills.
Technology to help keep people safe.
To make sure everyone is healthy.
Feeding people, educating people, cleaning the air, exploring the oceans or space. We're changing what people believe is possible.
We want to have an ideal future, and it's up to us to build that.
We don't care who you are or where you come from. If you're able to accomplish this task, you win, and that's it.
It's pretty simple. We do believe in creativity of the crowd, and as long as we focus them, we frame the problem in the right way and show them what they need to solve. We feel that the solutions are out there and they can do it. We've launched successfully $150 million worth of prizes, and we have another $300 million of prizes in the works. I'm telling you all this because you need to check our website continuously and apply for these prizes. The first one is now commercialized, so Richard Branson actually commercialized the first winning solution into Virgin Galactic, and they're going to fly passengers this year. It went public this year, last year. I don't know what's their market cap right now, but they actually reached $6 billion in market cap, which, again, these are companies that did not exist and would not have existed without this competition. The Google Lunar is the most successful failure we've had because the prize was never awarded. It expired without anyone winning it, but the teams continued on. $400 million was spent, and the concept of lunar economy didn't exist before announcing this prize. And the team from Israel actually ended up making an attempt. They landed, not in one piece, but they landed on the surface of the moon as the first private company that actually did so. And Now the Japanese and the Indian team are also getting ready to launch. We have three active prizes, IBM AI for Good, that we were supposed to announce the winners at the TED conference, which is now being delayed. We have a carbon capture prize that takes carbon out of the output of a coal plant or a natural gas plant and turns it into a valuable product. Very excited about that. And then ANA Avatar X Prize, which is a prize that combines AI, machine learning, AR, VR technologies with haptic and sensing technologies and robotics to create a complete avatar that allows you to remotely be present and sense and act as if you're physically there. The new prizes that we have in the works include one that I'm very excited about. I'm not going to go through all of them, but one that I'm very excited about, and hopefully we'll be able to announce that at the end of this year, is a carbon extractor, which is pushing the technologies to extract carbon out of the atmosphere to the gigaton level, because that's where we need to be. There are lots of technologies out there, but they haven't scaled, so this is more of a pushing the industry to scale and scale fast, because we need the solutions faster. We have a coral restoration prize we haven't announced. We did announce our rainforest prize, so if you're in AI and machine learning, actually this is a lot of data and robotics involved in this prize as well. We are about to announce a cell-based agriculture prize, which we call it Feeding the Next Billion, and the Lost Children is about identity and making sure every child in the world has an identity so they won't be lost in the system. So that's sort of XPRIZE in a nutshell. I'm going to quickly tell you a little bit more about what's happening in the world of space and space technology, because that's what excites me every day as well, alongside of my work at XPRIZE. So you all know about SpaceX. You hear a lot about their work. Just I think last month they announced that they're going to fly commercial passengers, they are even potentially doing a lunar orbit with their commercial passengers. So their Dragon capsule is getting ready to fly astronauts, and they're going to use it as well to fly commercial passengers. Blue Origin, Jeff Bezos' company, has the new Shepard, also built to carry astronauts, but also definitely have plans to carry commercial passengers. Another one that we don't hear much about is Bob Bigelow. He bought technologies from NASA to build sort of a inflatable space station or hotel that orbits around the Earth, and the Genesis project is actually the test model of that's orbiting Earth right now, and I think there is a webcam on it. You can go look at it. So this is a little bit about getting there, which is all about changing technologies to reduce the cost of access to space. Because if we are going to build businesses up in orbit, the first problem we had to solve was reducing the cost of access to orbit. But other technologies alongside of that is 3D printing is another technology that's changing the whole way we access and live and play in space. Made in Space is the company out of Singularity University that I had the pleasure of being there when the team was formed. And they have two printers on board the space station, printing tools and allowing us to not have to carry everything up to the space station and print things as we need. It's in the early stages, but, you know, if you watch Star Trek, you know, the replicator. This is the version of the replicator. Eventually, you can print everything. Another very interesting, this is more of a recent a project, and actually ESA is behind this one, is a printer that is going to eventually be able to print organs in space, because printing organs, especially the ones that are more complicated, it's difficult in the microgravity of Earth. So when you put it in space, in the gravity well of Earth, so when you put it in space, it allows you to be able to print a finer and more complex structures. So this is actually very, very exciting. experiment that's going on in space right now. And also larger structures as we set our sight to build stations, habitable stations on Moon or Mars, looking at in situ material and how we can actually build the structures out of those materials or print the structures there. 3D printing technology is also being used as creating things that we can wear, but also eventually maybe things that if you want to really go further and live and play and stay longer in space, perhaps implantables that would make our bodies more resilient in order to stay longer in space. So I always get criticized when I talk about space. Everyone tells me, we have so many problems here on Earth. Why do we spend money in space? And I have to always remind them that many technologies that have helped humanity here on Earth actually developed as part of the space program. All of our communication and GPS and a lot of things that used in banking system, remote medical diagnostics, a lot of things, material that we used, all the light materials came from the space program. And there are more exciting projects related to space technology, such as space solar power satellites potentially being able to collect energy of the sun and provide us with renewable, clean, sustainable energy indefinitely, hopefully, until the sun goes out. Also, as the electronics are shrinking, the cost is reduced, sensing technology and imaging technology is miniaturized and the cost is reduced, it has allowed us to actually be able to launch these satellites, CubeSats and microsatellites that capture amazing information about our planet, has allowed us to collect data in a much more granular level about our own planet and how it's changing. Not to talk about communication, you've probably heard of Elon just successfully launched, I think about 90, I think the entire constellation will end up to be around 300 some odd small satellites. There are at least three or four more projects of constellations of satellites to provide us with a global network. So all of these are great, but this is an actual picture of what it looks like out there. When you think about space, sometimes you think this wide empty spaces, and there is a lot of wide empty spaces, but when you talk about around our Earth, there's tons of debris and satellites and junks that are actually orbiting, and as we say in XPRIZE, every problem and challenge is a great business opportunity. So if you have solutions for space debris, I think it will be very well received by the investment community, because a lot of these satellites, especially the ones that are in the geo-orbit area, they're very, very expensive assets. And when you hear about some satellite that, or piece of a satellite that was deorbiting, hitting something else, it's really, people are not happy about that. So if you have a solution there, that's a great business opportunity. Another one, I don't know if you heard just a few weeks ago, Jeff Bezos announced the $10 billion Earth Fund. And of course, everyone should have applauded him, but there was all this article about how Amazon is also polluting our planet. And not specific to Amazon, but because, this is on the business side, this is an area I'm very familiar. I've been talking about this for the past maybe 5 years and talking about how data centers really don't belong on our planet. The reason being is they're just a bunch of machines. They need to be kept cool. They need a lot of power. And guess what? Out in the orbit, when you're in space, it's really cold. You have the sun there. The space station has been using solar panels to collect energy of the sun forever. We've been having computers up there forever. So as long as we can, we don't need like a very quick real-time, applications, it's the best place to put data centers. So finally, I heard an entrepreneur the other day say, I'm going to do this. And so he's fundraising and trying to build orbital data centers, which will be very cost effective. No rent, no cost of energy, no cost of cooling. Imagine. A great business model. So this is the one picture of what that may look like. But all those pictures we take all the time of the cats and dogs, they can all reside up there without polluting our planet. Who has seen Space Odyssey? So you recognize HAL. But we have an equivalent of a nice HAL on Space Station now, Simon, which is the first AI assistant on the space station, and astronauts are interacting with it and using it. But AI and machine learning is going to be a big part of the future of space. Already it's being used on looking at a lot of data, old data that's been captured by satellites and the orbiters and the landers and our information we've collected about the universe, and trying to go through that data, actually find Earth-like planets and other objects that we have missed before. And, because we have to talk about science fiction, a lot of things you see in science fiction is, becoming part of the real world now. We are creating a collective mind. Imagine being able to share your skills and knowledge with each other, and not only hooking up your brain to a machine, which is happening already, but also new experiments of hooking up the brains of many people together to create a collective computing power of all of our brains acting as a collective. It sounds familiar, right? You've seen it someplace on a movie, someplace. But does that mean that we will eventually have implantables that will provide that on a continuous basis? Will we look like Borgs when we go to space if we want to build colonies outside our Earth? Will that require us to change who we are as human beings? Who knows? These are all hard questions that I think they're fun questions to ask. Some of the answers we may not like, but I think it's important for us to have the courage to ask these questions and decide whether that's where we want to go and what we want to do.
Climate change,
deadly earthquake,
a suicide bomber,
terrorism,
nuclear device in the heart of the nation's capital.
It's no wonder that we're pessimistic. It's no wonder that people think that the world is getting worse. But perhaps that's not the case.
Perhaps we forget that we've only just begun.
Doing what's never been done before is intellectually seductive, whether or not we deem it practical.
What we're seeing is unfathomably new possibilities all of a sudden becoming available to us.
The future doesn't belong to the faint-hearted. It belongs to the brave.
You have to trust in something. Your gut, destiny, life, karma, whatever.
We truly are living in an extraordinary time. And many people forget this.
So now technically your device is on. Hey, Jeff, can you hear me?
The yearning to do what we do in the service of something larger than ourselves.
Where did we come from? Are we alone in the universe? What is the future of the human race?
When you conduct those exercises, innovation follows just as day follows night.
We can do this. I know we can because we've done it before.
Stay hungry, stay foolish.
So I know at sometimes, especially when you're here and talking about coronavirus and all the unknown, we may be overwhelmed by fear. But I've learned in my world that whenever you make decisions out of fear, they end up being the wrong decisions, especially long term. So one thing that we promote, something that's close to my heart, and I've tried to practice it throughout my life, is making decisions out of hopefulness. Because that's when we make our best decisions, that's when the creative mind comes around, and it allows us to really build the future that we want to build. So with that, I'm going to show you one last video, which is the short video of my launch, and then I'm open for questions.
Heart is a blue, shoots up through the stony ground. There's no room, no space to rent in this town. You're out of luck, and the reason that you had to care, the traffic is stuck, and you're not moving anywhere. You thought you found a friend to take you out of this place, someone you could lend a hand in return for grace. It's a beautiful day. Sky falls, you feel like it's a beautiful day. Your love is down. Even if that doesn't ring true, you've been all over, and it's been all over you. See the bed when fires at night, see the eyes at first
light. 9,
see the boat,
8, 7,
after the flood,
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Liftoff of the Soyuz rocket transporting Michael Lopez Alegria, Mikhail Turin, and Anousheh Ansari to a microgravity home in space.
Touch me. Take me to that
beautiful day, and you should never let a good day get away from you. So thank you. So I'm ready for your questions.
I'm just curious to know whether, I don't know anything about space travel.
No.
But with the emissions from rockets and tourism in space, I'm just wondering how those two things are reconciled.
So the technology used for launching rockets, especially the type of rockets that carry the passengers, is not toxic. There's some toxic component, but compared to even airline travel, it's nowhere near that. Even with that, there's always there's research going on to even replace those small toxic elements of
the.
It's mostly liquid oxygen, and there is some material that's like rubber that's burned during that process. So that's the small toxins that it's generated out of that. You're welcome. Yes.
Thanks for your talk. Oftentimes when people go to space, they say it changes their thinking. What, if anything, changed for you after you came back?
It's true, because you have this rare opportunity to see the world through a different lens. And for me, it was the same. when you look at our planet, first of all, the first time I saw Earth from space, even though I had like a million pictures of it always around me, it just had a different impact on me. It was like I could feel this energy of life from Earth, and I can't explain it, but it was there. It was palpable, and it made me very emotional. And the whole time I was there, as I was looking at our planet, it helped me sort of put things in new perspective, and sort of it was like I was very focused. Everything came to focus for me as to what's important. And the relationship I had with the world around me and people around me changed because of it. You clearly see how our planet is just very different than anything else around, how that very thin blue layer around it, which is, you know, the size of a skin of an apple, if our planet was the size of the apple, that is the only reason we're alive on this planet. And, you know, all these borders and crazy things that separates us and makes us feel like we're just, you know, this country or that city or this race or that race, it really doesn't exist. We're just so interconnected that it becomes obvious from up there, and we completely get so immersed in just what's around us and what we can see with our eyes that we forget about it. And when you're up there, you see it clearly, and it changes the way you behave. Yes.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story. That was just really inspirational. I just had a question about, you're in a very male-dominated space. What are some of the challenges that you've had to face in your
Good question. So let me see, how much time do we have? I'm an engineer, so I was one of very few in the engineering school when I started. As a young woman CEO in tech industry, I was one of very few. So getting investors and investment money was very, very difficult. Even in the space industry, even today, there's a lot of bias around women. But I never entered any room with that in mind. I always done what I felt that it was the right thing to do, what I wanted to do, and didn't care what anyone else felt or thought about it. And I never let other people's opinion of me or what they think I should or shouldn't do sort of drive me to and drive my actions. So even though I had to work harder and prove myself over and over again, that, you know, has been my model of proving people wrong. Now, I hope that the new generation of women won't have to work as hard to get what they deserve. But I think for a lot of us, we can just complain about it, which we should complain about it, but we shouldn't just complain about it. We should definitely push the boundaries. And I think when I went to Russia to enter the program, the first meeting I had was with my husband. He came with me. And the general who came to welcome us, he wouldn't even talk to me. He kept talking to my husband. And he's like, I'm not going. She's going. I need to talk to her. And he just, no, you know, space is good for men. You should go. And he's like, I'm not crazy enough. You can't pay me enough to go. But I have to tell you, the first 2 months was very difficult. They did everything to push me to leave. And I was just, I'm here. I'm not going anywhere. After the first 2 months, they saw how interested and they saw how excited I was to be there. They started working with me better. By the time I left, they were my best friends, and now I'm in touch with them. After I left, 2 new women astronauts applied to become part of the Russian space program. After Valentina Tereshkova and someone else after her, they had no women in the space program. So that to say that sometimes, other women, when one person pushes the door open, then there are a lot of women who come through, and that's what I hope to see in the future. That these areas that we don't have a lot of women, I love to see more women engineers, doctors, scientists. We need a lot more women, especially in AI and machine learning, which the biases are going to create a lot bigger problems in the future. So women engineers, if you see them, encourage them. If you have young people in your family, encourage them to consider STEM as a field. Let me ask someone in the back and then I'll...
Hi, thank you so much for your presentation. I'm a business student here, and I think of the many people I've seen standing on the stage, you by far have come across as the most grounded and the most humble, given that you've been up there. And so my question really is, for all the entrepreneurs in the room who are thinking big thoughts and big ideas, how do we remain as humble as you have just shown?
Thank you. I never let anything get into my head because as I told you, from when I was really, really young, I've seen things change like this. There's only one constant in life, and that's change. So as soon as you get too comfortable in your own skin and you just get comfortable with what you've done, something will change. That's one thing. The other thing is, I'm a lifetime learner. I love to do new things. I love to solve problems. I love to work on new things. And when you're always pushing yourself with new challenges, that humbles you. Solving problem humbles you. Working with smart people all the time and looking at what they can achieve. I don't think I've done much, but I get inspired by all those people who, don't have anything and they're at the first step of solving a big problem. And, even though the problem is big, they are going at it, and every day they show up and they push harder and harder. So I think surrounding yourself with a lot of people like that will always keep you grounded and humble.
Thank you very much for that. I've been following your journey for a while, and I think it's extremely inspiring. And, you've achieved so much already, and to the question above, also overcome many, many challenges. But where you stand right now, what does the next 10 years look like for you? What's the next frontier beyond what you're doing with the company, but having achieved so much already, where to from there?
So I am now, two years ago, almost, the board of XPRIZE asked me to actually take on as a CEO, so I have joined, I have now looked at XPRIZE as a platform that we can bring a lot of positive change. So two things that were important to me that I was able to bring to XPRIZE and create new programs. One was getting more young people engaged, so we're creating ways to really focus on young people and getting more young people engaged in our competitions and in different ways. So that's one thing I'm happy about. But another thing that I'm really excited about is looking at AI and machine learning was an area that before coming to XPRIZE started really, grabbing my attention, and how it's this powerful thing that's happening in the world, and not many people understand it. Not many people understand what's going on today. Everyone thinks it's out there, and it's not out there. It's here now. And so governments, institutions are not prepared and not having the right policies, which scares me in a way. But again, because I don't like to be scared, I wanted to be part of the solution. Also looking at biases that exist in the way the training data sets that are being used by a lot of these systems. So we have not publicly announced, but there's a big challenge that we will be launching at XPRIZE around gender data gap, for example, and looking at health, policy, design, many different areas, and looking at how we can really activate the community in addressing the gender data gap, and especially creating awareness. I think the big part of this program that we will run is just creating awareness about it and creating awareness about where we are with the use of AI and machine learning in every aspect of society.
Okay. thanks for your presentation. You come from a country that has an incredibly rich heritage of STEM ability and innovation. Now, obviously, there's a lot of challenges at the moment, but do you find any way to engage or with or encourage Iran through XPRIZE or elsewhere in that field?
So I haven't been back to Iran since I left and my family left, but I've tried to stay connected. And as you can see, I've never lost my accent. But so I do a lot of talks with university students over Skype and video conferencing. And there's a lot of energy inside Iran. There's entrepreneurship is well and alive. Actually, the STEM areas are very active in Iran. Unfortunately, because the way the society has sort of closed off communication and the borders from inside and from outside, information about all the important and incredible things that are happening inside Iran doesn't get out. So if the political situation somehow gets solved, which, you know, we've even started thinking, can we have an XPRIZE for that? We haven't come up with a solution. But if the political situation gets solved, I think you will see a big flourishing of entrepreneurship and creativity and collaboration. People inside Iran are so hungry for collaboration, and they compete for XPRIZEs, but they can never win because we won't be able to allow. If they win, we wouldn't be allowed to give them money. But it's a shame because it is a country with a rich heritage, with amazing history and places to see. And the fact that it's closed off from most of the world, it's hard to see. Yeah, wish I had a solution. No. Yes.
Boldly beyond where nobody else has gone before. I was just wondering that now that we're just starting to fabricate or set a foundation for future colonization and existence to take place in space, are conversations around culture and anthropology and sociology and how we will exist as humanity, is that a discussion that you're beginning to have? And how are you, like, in that discussion, what are the things that you're talking about? What are we going to do? How are we going to ensure that we're not going to make the same mistakes as we did here? Even in science fiction, Star Trek, Star Wars, it's all factionalism is a big thing. People are divided all across the galaxy. How do we ensure that we don't make the same mistakes? And if you could enlighten me regarding, you know, the conversation that you're having around it and the kind of technology, for example, say, for instance, use of data, use of blockchain, or, you know, have evaluation and metrics and frameworks that go around that discussion.
Yeah. So the only solution that I have to ensure that is if we can genetically remove greed from human behavior, that would be the only thing. But so I don't think there's any way we can ensure, but there's a lot of conversation around these types of topics, but very early stages of those conversations. I think a lot of activities are focused around solving the physical problems of living in space. There are many looking at how to create closed-loop systems, which will be really beneficial also for us here on Earth. They're looking at how our bodies will be able to live in space. But a lot of that, as I said, you know, if you start implanting things, if you start augmenting who we are as human beings with different technologies, are we still human? Are we part of the same sort of social structure? Very difficult questions to answer. We don't know. But conversations need to happen. They are happening at a very, very low scale and distributed. So a lot more is needed, definitely. Whether we will create the same types of problems, if we continue down the path we are on right now, yes, we will. But I hope that we will be smarter and, you know, before we actually get to a point where we have enough technology to live in space, hopefully our intelligence will catch up and we actually become intelligent beings. So we'll see. Thank you. Thank you very much. It was great to be with all of you and share my story with you. Have a great day.